Welcome to Speducation, the special education podcast by speducators and for speducators, where we discuss all things related to special education, or as I like to say, speducation, from the point of view of professionals working in the field. I'm Sarah Perkins, a nationally certified school psychologist currently practicing in a junior high in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
I'm Leanne McElwain. I'm a special ed teacher at an elementary school and have a background in secondary schools as well.
In this episode, we are very excited to have our first guest to talk with us today about behavior plans. Katie Getty is a school psychologist, and she and I met because we are both on the board of the Wyoming School Psychology Association, except Katie has the harder job of being the conference chair. She also works as a contract psych in Sheridan One, and she teaches at Eastern Washington University in their school psychology program. So welcome, Katie.
Thank you.
So today what we wanted to talk about was behavior plans, because behavior plans are tricky. And I know over the years, Lan and I have talked, and I don't know that we've ever felt like we just rocked behavior plans this year. Mm-hmm. And I think almost every year we're like, we're going to do better.
Right. And I think we might get one part, like we'll be happy with how it's written, but then the implementation is tricky, or implementation might be going well, but not getting the target behavior.
Exactly. So We're hoping that Katie, that you could share with us a little bit, because you do teach classes on this and you do behavior plans, that we want another perspective and somebody who could maybe share what you've seen as the hardest things for behavior plans and what you've seen work in addressing those problems.
Sure. I think behavior plans are challenging because they're a living document and they always need to be changing as our students' behaviors change, as they are learning. Maybe there's extinction behaviors going on where things are getting worse. A lot of times teams tend to give up as it starts to get challenging, and we don't want to put in the work to rewrite things or to sit down and look at data. So that can be the most challenging piece, is that they're ever-changing, and we need a whole team that buys in and is willing to work through it until we get to that final goal behavior that we're wanting.
How do you get to that buy-in? Because I feel like it's gotten better. Like years ago, I had a teacher tell me, well, I don't reward kids for just doing what they're supposed to do. It was a kindergarten teacher, too.
Gosh.
She said, if they're supposed to do it, then I'm not going to praise them for doing it. And I'm like, tear apart your classroom. And I don't hear that as much, but I do hear just, I guess, overwhelm is the biggest issue.
Yeah, I think teachers, they are dealing with so much, especially post-COVID. I feel like it has just become that much harder to be in education. I think putting it into teacher speak, you know, teachers are used to differentiating instruction for their students. They want to expect one way to be the way that the entire class learns. If we restructure behavior to think that way also, like rewarding kids for what they should be doing, well, just because that's the behavior that one kid knows they're supposed to do, doesn't mean that another student will automatically know those things. And we have to teach it, just like we would teach, you know, a math concept differently for a student who wasn't getting it. I find that when I frame it that way for teachers, it seems to just click better. I think they assume the behavior piece, you know, the psychologists and the counselors, they can deal with that. But when you put it into those terms of, you know, we want them to be successful in your classroom, so we need to differentiate how we teach this concept, it seems to lead to better buy-in. And I find that if I tend to be the one leading it, and I try and be very positive and upbeat, that hopefully carries over to the rest of the team, and they get excited about those little gains also when we celebrate those. And so it doesn't feel like we're getting together to review data to see if, you know, they're changing this tiny behavior. No, we get really excited about it, and that tends to motivate the whole team.
So that sort of just attitude going in really makes a difference.
Absolutely. And celebrating the little things, like everybody as people, we want to feel like our little things are celebrated too. I mean, I get excited when an admin puts a little chocolate bar in my mailbox. I mean, it doesn't take much for me to feel motivated. So celebrating those little things with students too can help. And noticing with your teachers when they are going above and beyond and commenting on that helps with buy-in too. They want then to work hard for the student because they're getting noticed for that work also.
So once you have the buy-in in terms of like attending the meeting and being present, When it comes to like developing the behavior plan, I was just trying to think like what are the major pitfalls we've had?
I think one of the biggest challenges I've experienced is, especially at the secondary level, is being able to capture the environments that the child is in a manner that is consistent across the board and isn't too diverse.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. So writing a behavior plan, like in elementary school, you know the one classroom or maybe, a few with specials that they're going to be in, but at the secondary level, it's more challenging because they have a different teacher every hour. And so that can make it difficult. Absolutely. And different teachers have different styles. So in one environment, there could be issues, whereas in another, there's not.
Well, and we've
So
talked about secondary teachers are sometimes a little, they can be very much like their students, a little independent.
yes. Well, and that's where like having that team mentality, even if it isn't a behavior that's an issue in your class, still let's all try and be consistent so that we can have that behavior growth. So even if the teacher doesn't feel like they're affected, still pulling them in because getting their input even, treat them as the expert. So you don't have these issues in your class. Tell us what you do that seems to work really well with the student. So that can get buy-in too, is if you pull them in as an expert when really, we're wanting them to implement that behavior plan the same as every other teacher.
When you're getting data, especially at secondary, like do you personally go and observe a lot? Are you like the keep collector of all the information, or do you get it from your teachers? And I often teachers are vaguely resistant, I mean, and or busy in engaging in
Yes,
those conversations. So
sure.
how have you been successful with that?
Yes. See, and this is a challenge of contracting is that I don't get to be as involved as I wish I could be. In the perfect world, I would be able to go in and be able to collect data and take that burden off of the teachers. Unfortunately, with contracting, I don't have that much say. So I try and make it as easy as possible. Like, let's create a checklist that all they have to do is check, yes, these pro-social behaviors were done. Some of those behaviors of concern, here's check marks of what was seen there, and make it as streamlined and easy as possible. I've also done Zoom observations if I need to, which is great because the students don't even know they're being observed. It's a great way to get information on what that actual behavior is without that burden being on the teacher. So I like, if it was up to me, I'd like to do most of it, but I like to empower my teachers to be able to collect that data in a way that puts the least amount of time strain on them.
Actually, you got me thinking with the Zoom observations because some of our kids are pretty canny and, they know they're like, you're in here for me. And I'm like, no, I'm not. I'm just in here.
Yeah, right. I love when you walk in and an announcement is made that you're there to do an observation, and you're like, no, I'm supposed to be incognito. Don't tell them I'm here for them.
Yeah.
Zoom is wonderful to be able to get that bird's eye view, and they have no clue. So that's a great way to get some data.
I also think, honestly, it would be helpful for because I think sometimes the teachers, which I mean, this is a training issue too. We could train them better, but they don't know what to expect. So they're like, "Are you going to intervene?" Or I'll come over and talk to you and narrate everything the kid's doing. And I'm like, "No, just do your thing. Pretend I'm not
Yeah.
here."
Right. I think of me as a chair in the back. Like, just do your thing and pretend I'm not here. Yeah.
But I think that maybe I'm not sure. I was going to say in my school, but I think it's sort of our district. We have not really done a good job of including general education in sped processes and saying, like, just so you know, when it comes to this process, this is what to expect. This is your role. And so I think we could do, I mean, we can't change the district, but like in our building, we could do a better job of maybe. And I think also because I work at the secondary, I've been like, well, there's too many teachers. I can't know them all.
Yeah.
Whatever. Whereas at the elementary, I think I would go like to them before and say, hey, I think this is what it's going to be like.
I do think at the beginning of the year, it's all always so hard to get staff time,
It
like
is.
for presentation without sped. But if you could even have a half hour and just that be part of your information that is shared, like if I'm in your classroom, this is, what I'm doing.
Yeah, I think
Yeah,
you're right.
could be
I think
helpful.
we might end up doing that, so fingers crossed. All right, so we've talked through sort of getting data and getting everybody in the room. What's the next big thing?
Well, I think also when we're talking about data, looking at our data frequently. As in all things education, we want our decisions to be data-based. We said the behavior plan needs to be a living, breathing document. I'm a huge fan of once a week or once every other week looking at the data. That way, you're not going these long stretches of time where we're stagnant. We're always changing it to fit the kids' needs, which helps to shape the behavior faster. So I have a 2-week rule. If they are hitting their goal for 2 weeks, we increase the goal. And we're always moving towards that target behavior. If we're not successful, then we need to change up something with our reinforcement or the intervention. Maybe we need to do a little more coaching as far as behaviors that we would want to expect and help them identify ways that they could change those behaviors in the classroom. I think looking at that data frequently and adjusting, we never want to decrease our goal. Obviously, we want to keep that high bar. But if they're not successful, then we need to change our approach so that they can be successful. And getting the students' input is huge on that being successful. I think really often we tend to write behavior plans for kids, not with kids. So having our students be able to give us information why they feel the way they do, what things they're motivated by, you get more buy-in then. So I think that's really important, including them in that process and looking at the data frequently so we don't get stagnant.
I think that makes a ton of sense. I guess I was thinking, I was like, oh, have we ever done that in my schools? And I think we've intended to, and I think we get in the weeds. And so I was thinking, what would be, but I would really not want to schedule another meeting necessarily, but maybe if I had like a scheduled reminder to email out to the team at a minimum to say, how are we doing on this data? I think that would be because I think if I were to ask the case manager, hey, keep an eye on it every 2 weeks, they'd go, sure thing, boss. And they'd mean it, and then they'd have 3 IEP meetings, and oh, one of their kids is suspended, and now there's a manifest, and it would just slip their brain.
So here's what I always like to think of. We put in that hard work for those first, hopefully, couple of weeks or months, and that's going to save us months or years of time in the long run. We're going to nip this behavior in the bud. We're teaching that student what pro-social behavior we're looking for. And if we're really intentional about making sure those goals are curtailed to them and we're looking at the data frequently, hopefully we are extinguishing that problem behavior really quickly. And then we've got months or years where it's not a problem. Versus we put in this behavior plan, we somewhat keep an eye on the data, and it ends up stretching out for years and years. I mean, you've seen it before. Students who have been on a behavior plan since fourth grade and they're in
Yes.
eighth grade. That's not what we want. We want it to be kind of get in, change that behavior, get out. So, yes, it's labor intensive, but think of it as short-term labor intensive.
Was just thinking, like, one thing that's been sort of talked about lately in our district because we've had lots of changes and all the rules are changing is, does this kid need a functional behavior assessment and a full-blown behavior plan? And there's like these terms that are vaguely made up, or And then, or well, you don't need to do all of that. You could do a lesser behavior plan, and which I'm not necessarily clear in the minds of the speaker what they're intending. I think they're intending like mainly don't fill out the paperwork for an FBA, but I don't know that they're describing a difference that's actually meaningful. And so I'm wondering, given that you don't work in our neck of the woods, like, do you guys have like sort of layers of plans and distinctions around that? Because one of the barriers for us is that FBA is, is supposed to be an evaluation, which, I mean, sure, it's a barrier, but I agree, that's fine. But then we're supposed to get consent or have a meeting, and the psych needs to be involved. And then every time we change the behavior plan, we're changing an IEP, and it needs to be an amendment, and there needs to be a gen ed teacher. So it's like, well, don't change the behavior plan too much because that's a pain.
Right. Our district is the same way. I think
Okay.
for a lot of low-level behaviors, I think the teachers can identify why it's happening and want to just, they want that autonomy. They want to create the behavior plan that works for them in their classroom to see if that works, if that helps to stop that behavior. When that's unsuccessful is normally when I get the referral for an FBA. It's like what I thought was the reason why this was continuing clearly is not it because, I've taken away the attention or I've, taken away the escape or I've given them a way that they can escape that's okay with me and it still is continuing. So I need you to come in and collect more information so that I can better react to these different problem behaviors. So yes, we have different layers also. And I think a lot of that is just classroom management, the teachers wanting to take care of it themselves and then reach out for help when that's not successful.
I was thinking, I think part of it too is that, again, maybe that disconnect. I think often, maybe general educators, but maybe even educators too, sort of struggle with some of the basic concepts about, like you said, like the reason why they're doing the behavior. And I think sometimes that's not always front of mind for the people involved with the kid about this behavior has a reason and we need to like honor that reason. I think often people are like, sure, it has a reason. Like they just want to get out of class. And it's like, okay, well, if that's the reason, then like that's a valid reason from their point of view. And you're not going to convince them that that's not a valid reason. So we got to roll with that reason. And I think that's hard for education, especially like they just don't want to do work. Like work avoidance, I think, is the hardest one to get teachers to roll with because they're like, so what? I just don't make them do work.
Yeah, it's not quite that black and white. We can find some gray area in between there. I always, I say to my teachers, we get reinforcement. We come to work and we get paid to come to work. Many of us love our job and we would do it whether we got paid or not, but that's an admit it. That perk is part of why we show up and do our job. Some students are going to need that little more motivation to do the work for you. Maybe they're writing, like their hands get so tired because it's such an arduous process for them. And so, yes, they write a paragraph and they're done and they want to escape. How can we motivate them to write a little bit more so that they aren't trying to escape? And that's why I always stress to teachers why it's so important to understand the function of their behavior, whether we do a full-blown FBA or whether it's just, something that's casual that we can just say, hey, they're trying to escape their writing, and then work in a reinforcement for doing that work that has the same function. So they're able to get that need met in a way that is more pro-social or is that still gets the end result that you're wanting as a teacher, but with a little bit of compromise. We have to be willing to meet them halfway because if we really put our foot down and say, no, you have to write, a 3-page essay like the rest of your peers, we're going to have them do absolutely nothing because they're going to give up. Could we be okay with a 1-page essay? Finding that compromise is important.
Absolutely. Leanne, have you found that your teachers at your school like understand that concept, like the whole idea of like functional behavior and replacing it with something that still meets the kids' needs? Or are they like, I've never heard this before?
We have a pretty robust behavior support system within our
That's
school.
nice.
So,
Nice.
and they've worked on it for several years. It's probably been 5 or 6 years in the making. It's pretty impressive. So we do have, I think the teachers at the school that I work with are highly aware of, that behavior is communication and they've been tasked with being creative and what to expect from students and it, changing it up at all times. It just gets very tiring. And I think by third quarter, fourth quarter, while they're great, it's when those things continue to repeat that we get kind of bogged down and tired and more confusion around what are we doing, why we're doing it.
It's so interesting to me because, Leanne and I work in the same district. Our schools are 10, 15 minutes apart. We serve very similar populations. I mean, obviously different age range because she's in elementary, but the experience and knowledge and interactions between teachers is really different. And like at my school, and I don't know if it's because it's a secondary or because my principal, we've had new principals and they just haven't yet invested the time in that. But like a lot of my teachers are pretty invested in punishing kids still. And so that like that basic, so if I were to say to them, like we need to replace their behavior and like isn't one paragraph better than three paragraphs, like that would take the entire meeting, which is fine because that would be new. They'd be like, well, but they were bad. And especially when it comes to drugs or physical aggression or anything like that, I really hear that punishment mentality. Like,
It
yeah,
could be
he has to
hard.
feel it.
Yeah. And it can be hard to sell them on things that are the function of the behavior. Like I had a student who would get aggressive, but a lot of the time he was like blurting out in class to get that attention from peers. Like work was hard for him. I don't want to look stupid, so I'm going to just be the class clown, and I'd rather be funny than dumb. But he loved that attention. And so, I suggested, what if we have him be a kindergarten buddy? If you can get through this class, and we had a sliding scale down of blurts that were allowed. If you do, X number of blurts or less, you get to go and be a kindergarten buddy. And you can go with them when they go to the library. And the teachers thought I was crazy. Why are we rewarding this student? Why are we giving them that privilege when they haven't earned it? Well, guess what? The blurting in the classroom came down because he knew he had a reward to work for, but he got the attention he was craving from all those kindergartners that loved him. Like there's this fifth grader coming in and he knows my name. And it was like mutually beneficial for that student and the classroom. So across the board, it was a success. But to sell that and say, this, yes, it's a privilege, but it's a privilege that's going to decrease that behavior you don't want to see in your class. Trying to sell that can be hard, but it makes a difference.
When Leanne and I worked at junior high together, they had we had student assistants who would run passes and stuff, and we always were like, why can't our kids be student assistant? Why can't special education kids? And they're like, well, they need to be like good kids. And we're like, but our kid, he knows the school better anyway. He is always in the hall. He is your man. And so I was really excited last year because we had two kids at, and this is a different school, but we had two kids who were student assistant. One, he's like little Mr. ADHD squirrel who knew everybody and knew the halls, and he was so responsible. And then the other one was class avoidant, would not talk to anybody. So as long as he didn't talk to her, but she was happy to avoid class and be a student assistant. And I was so glad that finally, because I remember the first time we talked about that was probably like 7 or 8 years ago. And finally, like, it's like, no, like, we have this built-in tool and we're using it explicitly for the kids who don't need it. We're saying, no, anybody who needs it can't have the tool.
Well, and that fills a need for escape. It fills a need for attention. You to have a meaningful job
Yeah,
that they can
contribution.
partake in. Yes, they feel like they're a meaningful part of the school. That's a big part of behavior plan success, also, because often students feel like I'm the bad kid. I'm labeled as the bad kid. No matter what I do, that's my role. Well, let's flip that. Let's have, a part of their behavior plan is something that is a meaningful job that makes them feel like they are seen and appreciated in their schools. And man, that will really change their overall approach because, I have a teacher who's depending on me to bring them, whatever, their whatever's in their mailbox, whatever that task is. They suddenly feel like they have purpose. And don't we all feel like we need to have a sense of purpose and that people see good in us? So that can make a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes there's like some artificial structures that I think some educators love rules. And sometimes we have rules that don't make sense. Like one of them was students with IEPs can't be runners. But then another one that I encountered last year was you can only be a runner for 1 quarter. And it's like, well, why? Like as long as they get all their classes, why can't they be a runner every other elective? And they're like, well, they need to take other electives. It's like, well, she's not going to go to art anyway. So like, can we just agree she's never going there? So let's just skip art and let her be a runner. And I didn't win that one. She only got to be a runner 1 quarter. But I think we're starting to make progress on pushing back on is this structure actually beneficial or is it just something we're used to? And I think that we've talked a lot, Leanne and I, about like inertia is such a powerful thing in bureaucracy.
And if it's not serving our students, then what's the point of keeping it going?
Let's see. I was thinking about behavior goals because they're part of FB, they sort of are part of FBAs, but then they're part of other services too. And I personally, I don't know how you feel, Katie, I sort of like it when like it shouldn't be only in this one context. Like the social worker could support it and various people could support a behavior goal. But I find they're really maybe hard to write, hard to measure in terms of, because we sort of want to write towards learning skills, but as a kid gets more skillful, you tend to notice their behavior less. because that's the entire point.
Right.
So I don't know, what are your thoughts about that?
When I am writing goals, I always say start with the biggest behavior of concern. Often we go in when we're writing behavior plans, we want to fix everything. Let's take every behavior the student has ever had and we're going to write a plan for it. Well, if we're trying to fix a million things all at once, none of them are going to be successful. So I always say pick the biggest behavior of concern. Obviously, the overall goal is that they're going to spend more time engaged in their coursework. We're going to have more time on task. We're going to have more homework or classwork completion. Like, that's the overall goal. But what is the big behavior that we want to work on? Let's teach the skills to successfully extinguish that behavior and find how they can get the function of that behavior in a more pro-social way. The hope then is that those skills trickle down to those lesser behaviors, but we have to build in some planned ignoring then. If I have a student who's flipping a desk and talking back, I can maybe ignore talking back while we work on the desk flipping. And as they learn more self-control, hopefully the talking back will take care of itself because they have the skills in place to stop that as well. But if it doesn't, then I can, once we stop flipping desks, we can move down to working on the talking back. But I say have it be very targeted, have it that anybody could look at that plan and it's very behaviorally descriptive versus being vague. We want it, if a dead person can do it, it's not a good goal, right? So have it just be very specific and the biggest behavior. And once that's met, move along.
So you're definitely focusing your goals, which is how what I do too, on decreasing negative behavior. I mean, by learning skills, but you're not trying to observe positive behavior so much as trying to notice, because that's what's noticeable is the negative behavior.
Right. The way I write my goals is what skill I'm going to teach. So my goal itself is written on what skill we're increasing. But obviously, as I'm writing the behavior plan, it's how are we going to work on decreasing this behavior? What are the skills that we're going to teach? It's kind of, it's multifaceted. We know that there needs to be a behavior decrease for there to be a positive behavior increase. So you need to speak to both of them. But the goal itself is written for what behavior we're going to increase.
You mentioned the planned ignoring, and it made me think when we were talking earlier about giving up from the adults. And I think that, like, ignoring, I actually I've talked a lot with teenagers last year. We would talk about, like, well, what would happen if you ignored them? And, like, can you ignore them? And I started asking them, like, how likely is it, do you think, that you could ignore someone if they said something about your brother? And they're usually pretty honest. They're like, no, I'm not. That won't happen. I will not be able to ignore that. And I'm like, thank you for being honest. That's great. I think sometimes adults are a little less honest with themselves. And they're like, I remember years ago we came up with a behavior plan, and the teacher, I think it was it only one day? It might be been two. And she's like, it's not working. And we're like, friend, come on.
I think as adult, we get in this headspace of like, well, I'm the adult, so you need to acquiesce to whatever I say because I'm the adult and you're the student. Well, especially when you get into secondary and you have these teenagers who are trying out these different personality, they're trying to figure out who they are. Getting into power struggles with someone who is
Yes.
trying to figure out who they are, you've already lost.
Yes.
So it's just a matter of the things that really don't matter in the grand scheme of things. Can we just let it go? There really is no need to be right because all that's going to happen is they shut down and we have nothing meaningful from that interaction or our time together. So yeah, that can be a struggle for to convince our Gen Ed teachers with as well. The planned ignoring. It's like, well, I wouldn't let anybody else do that. Well, they also aren't struggling with all of those bigger behaviors.
Well,
We have to pick our battles.
yes, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, weirdly, the secondary teachers are more, well, if I let them do it, then everybody else is going to think they're allowed to do it, or, well, it's not fair to the other kid. And elementary teachers are like, no, the kids get that pe different people are different. And then, like, it's like they lose that skill. I mean, which, to be, teenager brains are weird, but I don't necessarily, it's really interesting. I don't know, Leanne, if you've noticed that, like, now that you're back in elementary, the teachers, I feel like, are much more like, oh yeah, no, I can sell this to my class, that he's different. And the secondary teachers are like, What are you gonna do? I don't know.
I know. And I don't want to cut off this part of the conversation, but I also wonder about getting buy-in from parents, like, because sometimes parents come in and they want
That's a really good
a
point.
major shift, or they don't see it as important as the students. So,
That's a
yeah.
really good point.
Yeah, I think that's where that homeschool collaboration is so important and finding that compromise. So maybe it at school-wise, it's not a big deal to me, or it is a big deal, but we need to work with parents to find what that happy medium is. Because if we don't have consistency, it's also not going to be successful. So there might be something that we really want to work on, and the parents are saying, we don't really care about that. Okay, so how can we make it a little more school appropriate so that they're able to stay in the classroom, but maybe we focus on something that is more of an issue? That homeschool collaboration is huge.
I think that's such a good point because so I feel like it goes both ways. Like sometimes we get the parents who are like, well, I told them that if anybody says anything about their sister, they should punch them.
Yeah.
And then on the other hand, some like last year I had a lot of parents where I'm like, so we need to figure out how to help him be more successful. And they just like look at him and be like, you better shape up. And I'm like, well, that's not gonna help. Like
Right.
the sentiment's great, but like obviously if he could, he would have by now because we all agree you're terrifying. So
But that is a great opportunity for us as educators to be able to work with those parents, because obviously the skills that they need at home are not there. So we can help with saying, here's what we're doing at school. Here's how you can implement that at home. A lot of times when I'm writing behavior plans, I have recommendations for home and at school. We have a student who will
we're
lay their
excited
head
about
down.
that.
We have kids who are laying their head down and they're not doing anything that entire class. And the parents say, yes, I'll ask them to clean their room. And I come back 8 hours later and nothing's been touched. Okay, well, in class, we're going to start setting a timer and say, okay, you have these 3 minutes to get prepared, whatever, and then you can get started. And we'll set the timer a second time for how long they have to work on it. Have parents do that at home also with doing cleaning their room, and then they get a reward when they have been successful. And it might be you start out with all they do is pick up their shoes from the foyer and put them into their room. Whatever it is, we start small, but then they get a reward for that. And so I like to let parents know the things I think will help their student at school and give them ideas of how they can implement it at home. And once that student learns, oh, okay, if I watch this timer, for instance, and I get done what I need to do in that time period, I get something out of it. The buy-in is pretty darn quick.
Do you feel like your district has a lot of opportunities for parents to learn?
Yes and no. I think we could always do better. We could always have more parent involvement. I think for those parents, once they recognize that it's needed, the buy-in is great, but sometimes convincing them that we can be of help to them can be difficult. We have some opportunities for that parent collaboration, but not as much as I would like.
Yeah, because I was thinking like that's doing it sort of individually in the behavior plan, I think is great. But I'm thinking like almost especially with our parents of teenagers, like they often feel I don't know what else to do. And especially by the time I usually meet them, they're like, this kid, he's being suspended and, I don't know how to help him. And we do like love and logic classes through the district, which I think is great. But I don't know if our secondary parents, and I don't know. I don't know if there's a lot to support our parents, our secondary parents, and even we, that's pretty much as far as I know, the one sort of parent training thing we do.
Right. We have the PEEPS program that is, kind of a resource center for
Which
parents.
is awesome,
Yeah.
but
And I'm not quite sure how many, I don't have any statistics about how many families utilize that program or find it helpful.
I would love to know that. I know I recommend them all the time, but I know often when I bring them up in like IEP meetings, the general education teachers are like, say what now? Because mom will be like, yeah, I'm having a really hard time getting my car insured. And I'm like, you know who's good at logistics? Peeps. And the gen ed teacher's like, who's Peeps?
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm like, well, obviously you're not recommending it to non-sped kids if you've never heard of them. So yeah, I agree. I think we have some resources. We could have more, and the ones we have maybe are underutilized or maybe not. I
Right.
don't.
I'm familiar with PBIS World. Are there parent resources on PBIS World? I've never looked with that perspective.
Oh.
Great question. And all of the resources that I use, I don't know that there's a parent section. That's a huge need that they could fill. You know, have a tab for parents, and that could be hugely helpful.
I know that I think it was a while back, like maybe when my son was in kindergarten on like Class Dojo or something. You can assign points at home, but then it was like you have to pay. It was like you can assign like 2 points a day or something. But I was th when I saw it, I was like, oh, this could be useful because then we could say you can earn Fortnite V-Bucks because that's the only thing my kid wants to earn, based on your overall points at home and at school or something.
I
But
love that. Yeah,
it sort of
because
fell
then
apart. But
we're kind of increasing that good behavior across the board. Yeah, I think that would be hugely helpful if there was a platform that allowed for both that you didn't have to pay for.
yeah.
I just did a brief search here and there's a few that came up and maybe we could just provide
Yeah, we'll put
a
them in the show
few.
notes. Yeah, I think that's a good idea. For
Yeah,
yeah, and
absolutely.
I think maybe not with my junior high boys who, you know, they're too cool for school. They would not be excited if I was like, your parents are going to implement a point system for you. I'd have to massage that. But I think that's something we could implement. Hey, you know, you could do this at home too.
I know we've partnered with families and they've, done special outings if kids have been successful at school, that sort of thing. But I think offering some type of resource to build skill in parents as well, or even just knowledge of what their student's going through.
Speaking of like using incorporating parents into rewards, one thing I did a couple of years ago that was surprisingly adorable and effective is we allowed the kid to bring his mom in to eat lunch, and I bought them McDonald's, and we like all sat in my office and ate McDonald's together, and he was so proud to show his mom off to the school and vice versa. It
How
was like
sweet.
the sweetest, you know, and he thought he was like hardcore and he wasn't at all. He was like a little softy, but it was so cute how he like softened up.
Yes. Well, and even you were saying trying to sell things to those middle school boys. Everybody has a price. So, finding out what really motivates them. I have not found a student yet that there was nothing that would motivate them. So, yes, selling them on it can be hard, but when you find that thing they're really willing to work for, it might not look so bad to implement it at home and at school. So, you just have to
Yeah.
have a really good payoff.
I think we give up too soon.
Yes. Yeah.
With like, because I've had kids be like, no, I don't want to earn school store points. No. And we go, okay. And I was thinking, like, but I know he always has like super fly shoes. Like maybe we
Yeah.
could negotiate something with the shoes or, you know.
And that's where including a student in behavior plans is huge because we think we know what will motivate them. And we have forced choice surveys that, give us an idea of what motivates them. But sometimes even within the forced choice surveys, they're like, I don't care if I eat lunch with the teacher or not. But, if we include McDonald's and their mom coming in, now suddenly that lunch is really enticing. So including a student in really helps us know what is the most potent reinforcement so that we can use those things to really motivate them.
I just popped in my head. I've been seeing on some behavior plans. I don't know if they're from Behavior Advantage. I don't know. Our school district seems to have several different programs that are running simultaneously and unclearly. But one thing I liked is they had, as opposed to just, you know, what are you going to do to avoid the behavior and what are you going to do when it occurs? It was, what are you going to do when you start to see escalations and like, what does that look like for this kid? It had like layers. I don't know. Have you seen
I
that?
have not seen.
Have you seen that, Katie?
I have not, but that's something that I include in my behavior plans. And again, I will beat this like a dead horse. Having students involved helps us know this. Like, how do I know that you're starting to escalate? For some students, it's I shut down. For some, it's I start tapping my foot. Like they know themselves. They know when they're getting triggered. So for them to give us that insight so that we can step in before we get to that full-blown explosion or, whatever problem behavior that's really big is so helpful. And being able to point it out to them, hey, I noticed that, your hands are all fisted up in balls. I'm wondering if you're feeling frustrated with your worksheet right now. What can we do? And we're helping to prompt them then to have the self-awareness to start to take over some of those behavior changes in themselves before it becomes an issue. And then we're switching things from external to internal. They're learning things about themselves and learning that self-control, which again helps for all those behaviors to trickle down.
I like that. Yeah, when I saw that on a couple plans that I swear it was from in the district that I received, I was like, that's really smart because the way ours is currently written is it basically has like structures you set in place and then reactive strategies.
Yeah,
And it
and not
doesn't have
changing.
like what to do when you that's somewhere in between when you see it building,
Yeah.
but it hasn't yet become.
Yeah, I think we list antecedents, but we don't realize that antecedents can be the buildup, you know.
Yeah,
Sure.
you can
Or how
intervene
difficult.
then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is huge. I mean, none of us feel great after we have that big blow up, right? Even as adults. Like, there's times where I freak out and think, oh my gosh, I could have done that so much better. Kids feel the same way. They don't like the blow ups either. They don't like the negative attention that they get or having it reinforced that they're the quote bad kid, you know? So, being able to stay in control and have an adult support them in that really is helpful.
Research-based interventions that can be used. How does that tell me about like that conversation that you all have? Because honestly, in my experience in our district, we end up just sitting and saying, oh yeah, we'll try a thing. And there's no conversation about we don't really use outside tools or discuss if it's a research-based intervention. Maybe PBIS World, maybe like we have a check-in, check-out system built into our PBIS system. But beyond that, and then the problem, like at my school, is that we have the check-in, check-out system. So that's the solution to all the problems
Yeah,
because it's
oh, of
the least
course.
thing we have.
Yeah, and then checking out. Yes.
If you only have a hammer, they're all nails.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And check-in, check-out is helpful for a lot of students, but for those that don't need the attention, it's not really motivating to them. Having an adult to talk with, absolutely, but that's not going to really feel that need. I think having the evidence-based approaches, being able to be consistent, makes a big difference versus throwing spaghetti at a wall and seeing what sticks. Then every teacher is doing it a little bit differently. And the more streamlined of an approach that we have, you know, we're targeting one behavior with, you know, maybe two or three interventions that we're going to try. Having that streamline is going to lead to the most success because it's consistent between all the adults in the room. So yes, the PBIS World, I love. That's a great place to get some evidence-based approaches. The University of Missouri has a wonderful website that talks about evidence-based interventions and it breaks it down by the function of the behavior and gives you ideas of what you can do. The National Center for Intensive Intervention also has a lot of really great interventions that you can try that are evidence-based. And I think teachers a lot of times feel overwhelmed by, you know, what can I do? If we have a list of, you know, here's places you can go, or even if we create the list for them, if, you know, earning a tangible is what the function of their behavior, here are a couple things that you can try. And all they have to do is consult that list. It's a lot easier for them and less stressful and anxiety provoking.
I like that. It makes me think, I don't think we give, I guess in the gen ed teachers have like their PLC time, but I was just thinking, is there like opportunities for them to really problem solve about behaviors? And you said your school has like pretty good system.
The PLC process in our school is another very robust program that we utilize. And so, yes, that's a great opportunity for teachers to share data and say, well, this is what's working for me and my group with that student, and this is what I see. Yeah, the PLC process is, when it's followed, fidelity is very powerful.
You know, and
Absolutely.
I don't go to a lot of the general education PLCs, or I don't go to any of them, to be totally honest. So it's possible that they're working on that, but I do think at my school, there's definitely this culture of, well, if it's a special ed kid, that's a special ed problem. And on the one hand, I don't want the case manager excluded from the conversation about the kid. But on the other hand, it doesn't mean that we're the only people who can support a child. And I think maybe we can grow in that area. Like I was thinking, if our, and this year our special ed teachers are supposed to be more involved in the cores, maybe they could support the core and, yeah, no, you're right. He is struggling. Let's see what we can do before we take it to the sped department.
Sure. Well, and all students are gen ed students first.
Yeah.
So keeping that mindset that they're all our kids, because yes, the it's very easy to slip into the mentality of, well, those are the special education students, they're yours. These are the general education students, they're ours. Well, all students are general education students. So getting that buy-in and having it, I think, be a little more targeted so that they know exactly what to do and it doesn't feel overwhelming will help lessen that feeling of your kids versus my kids because they'll have ideas of what to do regardless of which kid it is, gen ed or special ed.
Absolutely. What do you think is the appropriate approach when it seems like the relationship is maybe irreparable between the staff member and the student,
Oh.
or at least in a very dark place?
Yeah, that's unfortunate, but it is a reality. There are times where teachers are so frustrated with a student, so burnt out, that it's hard for them to be able to see past that to start and repair the relationship so that we can get more positive behaviors. I think there's times where we just have to admit there might be just a personality clash here. I don't like everyone I meet. Like as adults, we feel that way. There may be times you just are oil and vinegar with someone else. So you have to maybe it's time to switch the class and go with a different teacher. For the most part, I encourage teachers to work through that. And I do a lot of consultation. And there's times they just need to vent. They're frustrated. They have dealt with these huge behaviors, all year versus with everything else that they have, and they are burnt out and they need a chance to be able to vent those pieces. I try and work in some counseling approaches there too and find ways that we can maybe sometimes lessen those thoughts of how severe the student is. We can get into black and white thinking, my easy students and my hard students. Okay, but with those hard students, can you think of any times where they've been really cooperative and really helpful and just to help to lessen that very dichotomous thought, working those pieces and then giving the student and the teacher an opportunity to repair. Maybe they are doing something non-academic together. The student's going to come and help wash the boards because they love that positive attention and they're going to go to that class for the teacher that they butt heads with. And there they'll have the opportunity to talk about what they did over the weekend and just find those positive interactions to help repair. I try and incorporate that as much as possible too. But if it's irreparable, sometimes it's just we need to switch.
That reminds me, Leanne, of what you were talking about one or two episodes ago with like that mindfulness and maybe applying that to those difficult students of, yes, the student grates on me, but today, their hair is super cute, or hey, at least they picked up their pencil and, wrote their name. And those
Yeah. And having those little things, and as the adult, telling the student that we're seeing that, like, hey, I saw that you picked up your pencil today. I love that you're engaged. Finding those opportunities to give the positive so that, again, they don't feel like, oh, I'm just the problem student. They just see me as the problem student. Being able to give them those positives. We want a 4-to-1 ratio, four positives for that every one redirection where we say, okay, it's time now for you to get to work. That's really important for relationship building also.
What kind of skill building do you typically, and maybe I guess it varies, but it just comes to mind that we have lagging skills, both teachers and the students. And oftentimes, for both parties, there's fear about being taken advantage of, or there's lack of boundaries. And so you've seen successful programs or anything in combination with behavior programs that set staff members, school environments up for success in building those skills.
I think it's, gosh, it's something that is different from teacher to teacher. And I find that there's a generational difference there too. Sometimes my newer teachers struggle with this because they feel like they have to be like overly firm because they're new and they don't want to get taken advantage of. But I also see that in my older teachers that like, well, previously I didn't have to say or do this. I think having those PBIS structures in place is helpful so everyone knows what to do and no one feels taken advantage of because there are boundaries, there are expectations, and we know you do this, this is what's expected. And it takes away some of that ambiguity and then some of the fear because it's expected. Now we have our students then who take those PBIS structures and are like, I don't care. I'm not doing, the things that you want me to do. Being able to work with them to chip down that defensiveness, but also doing that with the teachers as well. And this is again where counseling comes in really well. What's your biggest fear here? That if you do this, what's going to happen? And being able to lessen that fear by identifying what about that different experience is scary for them and how they feel they're going to be taken advantage of. And then be able to say, okay, so if you do feel taken advantage of, what would that look like? And how could we respond to that? So they feel empowered. Because if you feel empowered, then what could be is not so scary.
It's a really good point because I think I haven't necessarily always thought about that from the teacher point of view. Like I've had those conversations with kids, like, okay, I get that this, it's really scary doing this. What are you scared of? But with teachers, I think maybe, I don't know, because they're colleagues, the relationship's different. Like when I've had teachers say things like, you're going to be responsible for the next school shooting if you don't do what I want with this kid. Like really dramatic, awful things. But I think if I had maybe at that point circled back and said, wow, it sounds like you're really scared for this
Yes,
kid or for this situation. Like, tell me about that instead of saying this teacher has one, given up on the kid or is too determined to fight. Like, they're not interested in talking. And so, like, I'm done. I don't want to fight. So, I'm not going to engage anymore, which I believe is what I did at the time. I think if maybe I had said, wow, this is them being emotional, and I need to like hear that emotion rather than hear the adversarial nature of the words, that might have moved it along further.
Like what is it that feels so threatening about this student? Tell me what your experiences are. I find that that really chips down on defensiveness really quickly. And then they're more collaborative to help me problem solve. So how can we avoid this student being the next school shooter? Because we none of us want that. And it sounds like you feel scared in your classroom with them. What can we do? How can we build in some boundaries, some expectations where you feel more comfortable and the student also is going to feel more comfortable because we're going to work with them also. So yeah, I think sometimes hearing those things, not as them putting up a wall, but as them really bearing their emotions and telling you how they're feeling can be really big.
Sort of wish, I feel like educators should get built-in counseling like for their job.
I think that would help everybody.
Right. Probably everybody, but definitely at least educators.
I think we do have as a part of our benefit package, certain number of counseling
We do,
appointments. We have like a someone on board that we can call, and that's very helpful, but they're not in the environment, no. So I've always thought it would be neat to have like a community health center approach where kids can be seen, families can be seen, but I mean, I think those are typically more inner city types of
A
approaches.
little bigger, more resources.
It would be
Well,
nice.
we're going to be better, coming back to behavior plans, we're going to be better able to implement behavior plans if we're taking care of ourselves because we are completely exasperated and that student knows that and they know what our red buttons are. They're going to, play them like a piano. We need to be able to take care of ourselves and get to a space where I can recognize what my trigger is, but I can take a deep breath and remove myself if needed. And so I'm staying in control. That helps. We're able to implement our plan so much better when we have that self-awareness. So, yeah, self-care is huge. The counseling, taking time away, whatever you are needing so that you're in a space to respond appropriately to behaviors instead of being triggered and reactive, that is really helpful.
Well, I think that's something that educators are maybe in a good space to support because often with our students, we are not the ones spending the most of the time with them. I mean, certainly we as school psychs, but even like resource teachers. And so we are in a good place to be on the outside a little bit and notice, hey, it seems like you're getting sort of done with this friend. What could we do to help you feel to get to a good place with that? Like, what if he came and helped me all afternoon tomorrow, just so you could breathe? Or, and I think that that could be something that we are uniquely situated to be supportive with.
I think that would be so helpful for all involved, and it helps us in getting to know that student better. The more information we have about a student, the better we can respond to them, the better we can write our behavior plans and amend them. So having that full afternoon with a student and be able to see their different behaviors on a larger scale could be helpful just
Yeah,
from a research
win-win.
also. And it gives I think our teachers also appreciate when we recognize when they're stretched thin and we are able to support them. I think nothing says we're a team more than doing those types of things for one another.
Absolutely.
Education, education.